From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the short-form mobile video platform Quibi is drawing in tons of money and a lot of top talent to make content, but will it succeed? Then renowned pianist Katya and Marielle Lebeque recall a trip to Los Angeles when they first discovered the music of George Gershwin.
We never heard about Gershwin before because at this time in France, it was considered light music, Broadway music, not at all serious.
And we'll visit a long-running showcase for Asian American performers in Little Tokyo. All that coming up on The Frame. When you want to watch a movie, would you rather watch it at home or in a movie theater? How about another option, watching that film on your smartphone, but not all at once, rather in one 10-minute snippet a day? That's Jeffrey Katzenberg's thinking behind his short-form mobile video platform currently in the works. It's called Quibi, and the name is short for Quick Bites. There's still a lot of questions about how it'll all work before it's launched next year, but so far Quibi has been able to raise more than $1 billion and drawn some top creative talent. Elaine Lowe, a senior TV writer at Variety, has been looking into what all the excitement is about.
Quibi doesn't launch for almost another year, actually. It'll come out in April of 2020, but I think the reason why everybody is so hyped up about it is because you've got two storied leaders, one from tech, Meg Whitman, the former eBay and Hewlett-Packard CEO, and this giant of the industry, Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was at one time the head of DreamWorks and Walt Disney Studios. And he's really the reason why people are so excited about it, right? People are excited about it because he's excited about it. People believe in it because he believes in it. He's been selling this service as a mobile platform that'll house these quick bites, which is what Quibi is short for. And it's short form content that'll have premium, serialized, scripted content, unscripted content, news and sports. And it'll be released in these 5 to 10 minute chunks daily. And the idea is that when you're waiting for coffee or you have a dull moment in your day, those times when you're whipping out your phone and you're looking at Twitter or Facebook or something else and you're just putzing around on your phone, instead of doing that, you'll go to Quibi and you'll watch 5 minutes of a Sam Raimi horror anthology or 10 minutes of an Anna Kendrick buddy comedy instead.
So he has raised, I think, more than $1 billion to fund this. And right now, it seems like he has attracted some really interesting talent to make content for Quibi. I was at an event a couple of weeks ago where I ran into Antoine Fuqua, who a lot of people know from the Training Day movies. He's also made The Equalizer with Denzel Washington. And he was producing a movie for Quibi, and he was telling me that it was very attractive, even though I think this movie was going to be cut up into 10-minute chunks. What has Jeffrey's pitch been to the creative community, and what are people responding to?
Well, a big part of the appeal for creators is the intellectual property, because the way it's formatted, Quibi will exclusively license their projects for 7 years. But after the first 2 years, the rights revert back to these creators and filmmakers. So they'll be able to go and repackage this series. They'll be able to hopefully seamlessly thread together all of these 5 to 10 minute chunks of these stories and repackage them as a feature film, as a 2.5 hour project that they can then go sell to another service. So that's really the attractive thing. And also, again, there's just the appeal of Katzenberg himself because he has been so successful in this industry. I mean, Antoine Fuqua told me that sitting down with Jeffrey Katzenberg is like sitting down with the Godfather.
Yeah, although if you look at some of the movies he made at the Walt Disney Company and some of his animated movies, there are some questions about Jeffrey's storytelling taste. We'll save that conversation for something else. What is the financial model? Because a lot of people right now are thinking about disconnecting subscriptions that they might have to their cable or satellite company or Hulu or Netflix. So how are they trying to position it financially, and what are they expecting people to pay?
So they'll be selling two versions of Quibi. There'll be the ad-supported version for $5 a month and then the ad-free version for $7 a month. And it sounds like a small amount, but you also have to consider that people are, I don't know if they're near saturation, but there are certainly so many different streaming platforms out there. You've got Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and all of these different subscription services that people are already paying for. So that even when you've cut the cord, you've got sometimes a hefty bill at the end of the month when you combine all of these. So that'll be a real test for Quibi to see if they can break through that barrier and get people to forego for $5 to $7 a month for this. Of course, they're bringing some real A-list talent, and that's where their strength will lie. Again, you've got projects from Guillermo del Toro, Don Cheadle, Liam Hemsworth, Tyra Banks, Chrissy Teigen. And, you know, I think the other question here is also whether there will be, on the creator side, resale value for them after they're allowed to take their project off of Quibi, or after they're allowed to repackage their project from Quibi and sell it to a different platform.
So if there are detractors in town, or at least doubters, what would you say is the consistent question that they have about Quibi? What are going to be the obstacles to its success?
There are a couple of different questions that came up in our reporting. One of them is, do people want this model? People are so used to binging on TV these days. When you go onto Netflix, their whole thing is the binge model. This also isn't appointment TV. It's sort of a daily thing that comes on 5 to 10 minutes a day. But what if I want to watch the whole movie? So in that case, do I just wait for a month for all of these daily releases to come on the service and then, say, binge watch them all anyway on a Saturday afternoon? So that's definitely a very unique model that hasn't really been done before. Another question that people have is, people are so used to getting something for nothing, especially from a mobile device. So are people going to be willing to fork over $5 to $7 a month for Quibi? Yet another question is, will the viewership justify the cost? There are some really high numbers that are being thrown around. I believe Antoine Fuqua's project is going to cost about $15 million, which is certainly more than you can say for a lot of other short-form mobile video out there. And Quibi's model is subscriptions and ad revenue, and that's how they're planning on monetizing their service. But it'll be interesting to see whether the subs and ad revenue justify the amount that they've been investing into these properties.
Elaine Lowe is a senior TV writer at Variety. Elaine, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, the sister piano duo Katya and Mario Lebec reflect on nearly 40 years of music together. Welcome back to The Frame. Pianist Marielle and Katya Lebec have been playing as a duo for nearly 40 years. The sisters were born in France to a musical family, and since their acclaimed 1980 recording of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, they have brought international attention to music played by two pianos. They've performed traditional repertoire, such as Mozart and Brahms, and interpreted modern works of Luciano Berio and Philip Glass. More recently, they've commissioned new works by contemporary musicians, including Radiohead's Thom Yorke and The National's Bryce Dessner. When we sat down with the Lebec sisters, we started with when they first decided to play as a duo.
We start to play together late, only after we graduate from Paris Conservatory. We did all our study as a solo piano. That was a good thing. We had no idea of the repertory for two piano.
But I think it was very good to start as a piano solo. I think it is better to develop your technique and whatever, you know, to do Chopin study and to do all this repertoire. Of course, now we are not playing it, but it was really good that we could develop each other separately and then be together.
When you were performing at the same time, it would feel as if you have to have memorized the piece, right?
Yes,
that
yeah,
you
we
can't
do.
Be looking at music.
Yeah.
Also, you're facing each other, but you can't see each other's hands. So
no.
What are you doing in terms of making sure that you are working together? How do you go about that? And how much do you find through rehearsal? How do you get there?
A lot of practice.
Yes, we work so much.
We practice so much that we end up being really free. And we breathe together. We don't really think in terms of being together. We know we will be together. I think the difficulty in two piano is to be able to phrase separate line and to be able to conceive and have the perception of this phrasing. So sometimes to play too much together, it's really terrible. It sounds so mechanical. If you want the piano to sing, you need to be able to work on a way not to be together, but of course, if you're really not together, it's awful, but you have to find the very limit, the balance, which is very fragile. I mean, really, it's like walking on ice with big shoes, you know.
I think about what you do and synchronized divers, because synchronized divers have to do three things. They have to leave the diving board at the same time. Yeah. They have to enter the water at the same time. But what they do in the air can be very different.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that
sure.
basically you have to make sure you start and end at the same time, but that you're doing different things yeah. while you're flying.
We try to finish the piece together. It is true.
30 years ago, you came to Los Angeles to play with Luciano Berio.
Something happened
on that trip that was very important. What happened back
then? That was the first time we were coming to America, and people spoke to us about Gershwin, and we never heard about Gershwin before, because at this time in France, it was considered light music, Broadway music, not at all like a serious, you know, I hate this term of serious composer. For me, it's just good music or not, and it does not matter the style. But, and we said, no, we don't know Gershwin. So we went to a record shop, and we bought a lot of Miles Davis and Billie Holiday and Gil Evans and, you know, all those people. And we started to hear Gershwin through those interpretations. And later on, we record it. And then one day we receive a letter from Ira Gershwin. And I thought that was a joke of a friend of us or whatever. But no, that was real. And the letter had the autograph of Ira Gershwin and George Gershwin.
Because he sent us our record with a letter inside, with the autograph of George Gershwin.
He glued an autograph of George Gershwin. And that was so amazing. So he invited us to go and see him, and that we did. We were playing at the Ball a few years after, and we went, I mean, like 2 years after, and we met Ira, and that was really a very privileged moment.
I'm going to play a little bit from your performance of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. People who know this piece know that it's written for one piano. You've arranged it for two.
No. It's the original version for two piano.
Oh, really?
That's the opposite. I mean, the piece was written for two piano, and then George gave the part of the second piano to Ferdi Groffi to orchestrate it. But the original version was for two piano. If not, we would not have done it as first record. I mean, they used to hear the version with orchestra, big orchestra, and one piano, which actually Ira did not like so much. He thought that the version for one piano and huge symphony orchestra was out of proportion, because with a two piano you really hear what Gershwin wrote, and it's much more rhythmical, it's more accurate, and in a way it's more modern.
I want to ask you about another piece that was written for two pianos. That's Poulenc's Concerto for two pianos and orchestra. So that's a piece you first performed decades ago. When you revisit a piece like that, how does it change? How do you keep it fresh in your mind when it's something you've played
every
so time?
It is changing all the time. And recently, we were so lucky to work with Georges Prêtre, who knew Poulenc, and he conducted the piece, and he was a wonderful conductor. And again, you know, we change because he asked us to do things, and we change phrasing. And every time we worked with Simon Rattle, or we work with Georges Prêtre, of course, we play differently, but this music is so wonderful. And of course, we play a lot of contemporary music. But every time we play Poulenc, it's like opening a bottle of champagne. You know, it's so joyful and so, and in the same time, very dramatic.
We're talking with pianist Katia and Marielle Labeck. You arrange, but you also commission a lot of new works. Philip Glass, Bryce Dessner, and Nico Muhly have all written pieces for you. What are you looking for in new works, and how has that changed over the years?
I think it's important to stay connected with your epoch. I mean, we love to play also Baroque music, and that's great. And I love to light the candle at home. But in the same time, I love that to push a button, and we have all the spot going on, and the electricity works very well. I mean, so I would feel frustrated if I was not connected to my epoch. And I think to work with composers is a way to stay connected.
I want to play a little bit of a new work that was composed for you by Thom Yorke. Most people probably know him from the band Radiohead. This piece is called Don't Fear the Light. I think this is Thom Yorke's first ever classical composition. And what's interesting about Thom is I think he doesn't know how to write music. So what does that mean in terms of a collaboration with somebody who really comes from a seat of your pants rock and roll background?
But at the end, Thom is pure music. I don't care where he comes from. What the music he writes is always his music. And the only problem he had, but that was not a problem for us, that he said, but I cannot write. And we say, okay, so send the waves. And he sent the waves to David Chalmin. And David Chalmin transcribed his waves of sound into the score. And that was perfect, because I think Thom is one of the most important musicians of our century, really.
Tonight, you're going to be playing at the Hollywood Bowl, and you'll be playing Carnival of the Animals with the LA Phil by Saint-Saëns. And that piece was never intended, I think, to be performed. So
it's
why
so
is
ironic.
That?
It's so ironic that Saint-Saëns forbid the piece to be performed until the end of his life. And that has become now one of his most famous pieces. So, you know, you cannot control destiny.
It's kind of a silly piece, right? How would you describe it?
It's not silly at all. In fact, it is. It's amazing. It's so well done.
So well
beautiful.
Written.
So well written. And very beautiful and challenging also for the instrument, because the swan is difficult for the cello. The elephant, you know, for the bass player. But everything is short, and it's really just pure joy to play Carnaval.
But I think if you're taking a picnic, you should pack a vegan picnic for this
piece
of music.
Yes, definitely. That will be the case.
I taught my younger son how to play golf. He's had some other coaches along the way, but I remember when he became better than me. And I'm wondering, your mom was one of your piano teachers.
Yes.
Do you remember when you started playing better than her and what that was like?
Yeah, that was that's so funny to say that. Yeah, we did. We did become better than her. And she was so happy about it. And I remember seeing her in Carnegie Hall, and I could see her in the box, and she was crying, and she made me cry too.
Katya and Marielle, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Katya and Marielle Lebec perform Carnival of the Animals tonight at the Hollywood Bowl. Coming up on The Frame, we visit a long-running showcase for Asian American performers in Little Tokyo. If you're walking around Little Tokyo in downtown LA on a Tuesday night, you might stumble upon an outdoor performance and a rapt crowd crammed into a small courtyard. That's Tuesday Night Cafe, a long-running showcase for Asian American musicians, singers, poets, and their friends. But the series is more than just another gig for the artists. It's also deeply rooted in community, collaboration, and a sense of history. The Frame's Andrea Gutierrez has our story.
It's oddly chilly for a night in May, but that doesn't stop folks from filling up a courtyard in LA's Little Tokyo.
Who here is a first-timer at Tuesday Night Cafe? Computer first time. Wow, that's a lot of people. Welcome, welcome.
Sean Mura is the lead curator of Tuesday Night Cafe, and he's tonight's MC. The rows of folding chairs are full, but there are a few spots under the pergola in the corner with the picnickers. Among them is Jenny San Angel, a regular at these shows, and she doesn't come empty-handed.
I am the person who brings the whiskey. So I always bring, I got Jameson, which I'll share with you.
Tuesday Night Cafe, or TNC as it's known, is not a cafe in the foodie sense. It's the flagship program of Tuesday Night Project, a volunteer organization that provides creative programming by and for Asian American and Pacific Islander communities. The organizers believe that Tuesday Night Cafe is the longest-running Asian American performance series in the United States, now in its 21st season.
Dance with me now. Come and mix with me.
Twice a month, in front of a banner with a cartoon fortune cat playing a guitar, the shows feature an eclectic lineup of music, poetry, and activist outreach. Best of all, each and every show is free.
One time for my homies, they the plug to my OC, they just ride to my codeine.
I'm Tracy Katokidiyama, and I'm the director, co-founder of Tuesday Night Project that presents the series Tuesday Night Cafe.
Tracy's also an artist and performer. She and some friends started Tuesday Night Cafe in 1999 as a place to experiment with their own work and to carve out a social space in Little Tokyo. At the time, the neighborhood needed it.
There just weren't a lot of people walking around past dark. There might have been like four or five places that were open into the evening, and it just was a place that we felt was kind of fading away.
Tracy and her artist friends ultimately connected with the Little Tokyo Service Center. Community partnerships are what help Tuesday Night Cafe keep the lights on, literally. The courtyard is located at the Union Center for the Arts, which was once a church, and then during World War II, a congregation point for Japanese Americans being sent to internment camps. But now it's home to three arts organizations that provide free storage, free Wi-Fi, a free venue, which keeps costs low for the Tuesday Night folks.
I think it goes in some ways beyond expression. It goes beyond art even. It's really about people and working with people and building something up together.
Breaking and building is the theme of the night. It's the idea that if we tear things down, we need to imagine what we want in its place. Tuesday Night Cafe organizers see the theme as a continuation of Asian American activism going back to at least the 1960s. Topics like prison abolition, gentrification, and the detention of migrants come up throughout the show, which is not unexpected. Little Tokyo is only blocks away from the central jail and an immigration detention center.
You can build the highest tower. You can plan roads to the unknown. You can build wondrous bridges, but can you build a home?
Tonight's artists span generations. That's one of the things Tuesday Night Cafe prides itself on. The youngest is 17, the oldest has been a community activist dating back to the 60s. And about 5 years ago, Tracy handed off the curator role to Sean Mura, which came as a surprise to Sean. His involvement with Tuesday Night Cafe as a volunteer and then as a board member had been a labor of love.
It's such a privilege to be around artists. That's just such like a cool thing. And to be able to work with them and hear them grow is so awesome.
When I ask Sean if he's an artist, he hedges a bit. He jokes that he got his start on the Tuesday Night Cafe stage, wearing an ugly trucker hat and reading a bad poem. His words, not mine. But now he understands his art practice differently.
Curating a good show is much more of a process than I think people think that it is. If we are to understand art as process, then I think that curation for me is a really gratifying one, because it can't exist in isolation.
She said I talk too much.
She said I talk too much.
I hope everybody's having a good time tonight.
She said I talk too much.
Baby told me shut up and be yourself.
She said I talk too much.
What do you think of the show tonight, Tracy?
Oh gosh, I thought the show was amazing. I haven't danced like that here in the space in a while, so we were just all in the corner dancing and just like the music, the energy.
Volunteers gather chairs and pick up trash. Everyone will go back to their day jobs and schoolwork, and maybe some will dream of making it big as an artist. But Tracy's been around long enough to see performers leave the Tuesday Night Cafe stage for Hollywood, only to come back.
I call it the Asian American red carpet. I think that trying to so-called make it in any industry as an artist is very extremely difficult. And you can be super hot one year and super not the next. And the one thing that you will always have is this community, like, laying out that carpet for you.
Luckily, that community will be back again in 2 weeks, dancing in the corner, picnicking under the pergola. For The Frame, I'm Andrea Gutierrez.
And that's our show for today. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn in the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll see you back here tomorrow.